President Obama is giving Russia's Romanov dynasty a run for its rubles when it comes to naming czars. The Obama administration announced yesterday Washington attorney Kenneth Feinberg is the new compensation czar. He's going to help set the pay of the top 100 executives at companies who have been bailed out by federal dollars. This marks, get this number, the 15th czar to be named by this administration in 5 months. That's versus Russia's 18 czars, which ran the Kremlin for more than 300 years. So are all these czars really needed? And when will the president have enough? Here is my take. Number one, what precisely does the czar do? How do they get paid? And ultimately, who are they accountable to? Is it only the president? Number two, is this creating a bureaucratic nightmare? Or is the example in the case of the auto task force, the auto czar, an example of how to avert politics as usual? And number three, is one point person, given the number of financial crises, the right solution? Perhaps. Time can only tell. Joining me now for some analysis on all the czars in this country, Chris Kafinas is a strategic advisor at McMahon, Squire & Associates, and a former campaign director for the John Edwards presidential campaign. Nick Gillespie is the editor-in-chief of the websites Reason.com and Reason.tv. And Gary Lipshin is the founder of the Russian Comedy Network and RussianComedy.net. Quite a group, gentlemen. Good to see you guys. So, Chris, thanks. You know, I understand there's some history here with czars, aside from those in Russia. We have them dating back to FDR, to Nixon, et cetera. Why so many czars? Are they all necessary?
Well, I mean, first and foremost, I'm not sure that it's directly analogous to compare the czars that President Obama's appointing deal with public policy issues and the Russian czars, but putting that historical
twist aside. But you're smiling, you're laughing.
I mean, it's a kind of funny analogy. I mean, it's kind of a stretch to say the least. I mean, listen, at the end of the day, I think that the purpose of this is very serious, and that is you want someone to be appointed, if you will, to head this this division of an issue or a problem area that you have great concern over. And you've seen that with, you know, energy. You've seen that with healthcare. You've seen with the auto task force. And I think it's very smart because what it does, it allows you to put one individual who can go across agencies and basically becomes your point person. It's very similar to what I would say corporations do when they bring outside consultants to lead, for example, a task force, whatever that task force may be doing for that corporation. It's a smart bureaucratic tool to deal with a very difficult maze, especially when you have complex problems as President Obama faces right now.
So, Nick, are there concerns about having 15 czars, or you think that makes the role of government a little smoother?
Well, you know, in fact, Reuters is reporting that Obama has 21 czars, so we're not even sure how many czars there are, and, you know, I'm sure he can back up a van and add as many more czars as he needs. But, you know, the language here matters. I mean, I agree with Chris that one thing you look at is what are these people tasked with doing? In the case of the compensation czar, I mean, all this does is underscore how idiotic the TARP bailout and stimulus spending is. The government shouldn't be involved in this, and they should not be involved in running car companies, and they should not be involved in setting compensation. I mean, should they be picking the colors of the interiors for next year's fleet line coming out of Chrysler or GM as well? The government simply shouldn't be doing certain things. But when you look at the history of the czars, what you see, just like with the Romanovs, you see a track record of failure and empire building. Under Carter, there were inflation czars who did absolutely nothing to help the economic situation in the United States. Under Nixon, who appointed the first energy czar, a couple of years later, that became a cabinet-level agency, all to no really strong or clear end. The fact is that unlike in companies, czars and government officials are not really accountable to anybody, and that this actually screws up kinds of lines of communication. When you look at the drug czar, which is probably the only one of these czars that people actually know about and follow and hear about, the drug czar and the Drug Enforcement Administration, which are separate things, and various aspects of the Department of Justice, they all work at cross purposes, and most importantly, they fail at their stated goal of reducing consumption and ingress of drugs into the country.
Okay, so Gary, you know, look, you know a thing or two about Russia. I mean, is this comedic? Is this, you know, is this smart? What is this?
Well, Alexis, I mean, there's clear parallels here. I mean, obviously, Obama is very serious about czars. He's got 15. During the entire history, Russia only had 18. So I figure he's three away from a Bolshevik revolution. So we've got that going for him. The other thing, I mean, czar, I think, is a very appropriate name. Think about what a czar is. It's a power appointed by a higher power, so it's a perfect fit for that. As far as, you know, czars are really have monarchy power, so they're not accountable to anybody. They can do whatever they want, and this is a great way to deal with the situation. I think the more czars, the better. And just on behalf of the Russian community, I think it's great. It's nice to finally see, you know, American politics taking something from the Russia as opposed to going the other way.
Chris is smiling. I know, Chris, you think it's a stretch, but it's pretty fascinating when you actually look at the number of czars over 300 years in Russia and how many we have in this administration. But let's talk specifically. I mean, look, some of these names, Paul Volcker, you know, John Waters, I mean, you go through the list of some of the people on this list, and you've got some very well-known, some very well-established people who have either, for the most part, a lot of them have been in past administrations. What does that suggest about how this president is choosing to govern?
Well, I think it suggests something very important, that he's willing to listen to very important and accomplished forces. I mean, and going back to a point that was made earlier, in terms of, you know, in terms of whether these czars are successful or not, listen, the American people, as well as, you know, the media and others, are going to judge accordingly. But at the end of the day, look at the Auto Task Force, I think, as one example. You know, the president could have just assigned this to one particular agency. I'm not sure who you could have assigned it to. Instead, he put an auto czar. And in doing so, I think, helped kind of focus the attentions of dealing with a very particular crisis. Doesn't mean that you appoint a czar and the problem goes away. What it does mean, I think, it gives you an ability to focus your energies and bring in, hopefully, some really good, smart people who are going to also focus their energies and their intellect. And in terms of accountability, listen, they are accountable at the end of the day to the president of the United States. That's someone pretty serious to be accountable to.
Yep.
And the difference, I would say, between this president and others is this president is going to hold these individuals' feet to the fire.
You know, it's interesting, Nick, I use that example of the Auto Task Force. I know a lot of people don't like the net results, the net investment, but what the Auto Task Force did in a couple months is something that should have been worked on over a decade here on the auto industry. So would you not give them a little bit of credit for at least putting the...
What do you mean by that? The auto industry is one of the most heavily regulated and intruded upon industries in American history, certainly domestically owned people. The problem with the auto industry is not that it didn't have enough people telling them exactly what to do from Washington. The problem is that they had too many people doing that, and they had a series of really rotten executives.
Oh, Nick, you can't
at least
honestly
two of the
believe
three
it's
that's
what,
just not right.
That
that's
just,
wait,
that's absurd.
How many of you,
it's not Washington, D.C. that impacted
GM
the auto industry.
How
the executives,
many, no, no.
The contracts with labor
Here,
what, unions, it was so much bigger than that. They
yeah,
had egregious
all of
contracts.
That, all of that took place in the context of a government that created particular types of incentives for particular types of cars or not, et cetera. What I'm saying is that
it wasn't government
say, okay,
that forced
you know
him
what?
To greet the gremlin, for goodness sake.
Here, no, you know what? Actually, though, right, CAFE standards and things like that did have an impact. I agree. The U.S. auto industry is largely responsible for its own
demise. CAFE standards weren't even in effect.
And excuse me, but the point of the fact there are import quotas, there are export quotas, et cetera. There is all kinds of government manipulation of the auto industry. If you think that a czar is going to be able to come in and help GM and Chrysler after decades of mismanagement and foolishness and also, you know, obstacles being thrown up from the government, you know, it's like the cure is going to be the same thing as the disease.
Gary, you talk to executives
no, to
who have worked
honest.
For these corporations their entire life, and they say they had a structure, a payment system that was inevitably going to fall
that's
apart
stock,
regardless.
That is what stockholders are for, though. I mean, you know, it's not for you or me or anybody else to say what people in a particular company should make. Should Fox News be able to pay you one way and somebody else something else, or should any private industry? The whole point
right,
is
Gary,
to get government
let me,
out of something
Gary,
like
Gary,
that.
Gary, have
that's,
the last
look,
word, Gary.
If I may chime in here, to be a little bit more serious, I mean, the last pays are, you can't expect to give somebody $700 billion and have no accountability. So maybe it's not such a bad idea to have, you know, an outside influence to kind of take a look and see where is the $700 billion going? Is it going straight to bonuses, or are we going to spend this money doing something? So there's something to be said
for
czar power
occasionally.
And
what did the government do with
that?
What did What did the government do with the AIG bonuses? What did the you know immediately that this is all
going to be captured by interest. Yeah, but that's precisely what they're trying to avoid, appointing a person to look over this.
Yeah, no, and all I'm saying is that we already saw that happen already in the financial sector. What happened to the bonuses that that caused so much consternation?
Gentlemen, to be continued. I agree with you on compensation, too much intervention on some of these things, but these are outside people. They're supposed to, ideally, I guess, clarify the situation. I don't know if they do. The jury's still out. We'll continue our conversation. Chris, Nick, and Gary, thank you guys so much. Coming up, we've talked a lot.